Welcome to According to Sam, folks. This is episode 194. Thank you guys for watching. Happy Friday. I hope you guys have a great weekend. I have a lot to cover with you guys today, so let's get right into it. I want to start today's podcast talking about this chart. This was a chart that this gentleman, Robert Sterling, made, and he tweeted it out on X this past week, and I want to go over it with you. I'm glad people are finally talking about this, but what this chart reflects and what Mr. Sterling writes about here is something that I have been screaming into the wind, trying to warn people about. This is something that I identified at least a decade ago. I started writing a book, I guess it was about a decade ago. I didn't finish it. I got halfway through it. But the book that I was writing was about this tweet and this chart from Robert Sterling exactly. And I felt that, you know, that was one of the reasons that I didn't finish the book, because, you know, the book was about the history and how all of this stuff happened. And I felt that it was too late, you know, that it didn't even matter how it happened, how we got in this mess. We're in the mess now. And that's the book that someone needs to write, is how we get out of this mess. My book was basically going through the details of showing how what this guy writes about in this tweet, how this happened. And that's what I want to talk about in the beginning of this podcast, go over this tweet and this chart and explain to you how it happened. Mr. Sterling says, "This is the scariest chart that I have ever made. This is what it looks like when a country is headed towards a financial precipice. Each color shows $1 trillion. Here, I'll read it over here because I want you to see the chart. I have it up over here. Each color shows $1 trillion getting added to the national debt. Not long ago, it took 6 years to add a bar. We're now adding a bar every 90 to 120 days. We don't have a debt limit right now. If you guys don't remember, last May, the deal that Kevin McCarthy made with Joe Biden, when Joe Biden took him to the woodshed, they suspended the debt limit. So he says, we're now adding $1 trillion every 90 to 120 days. This explosion of debt has been the only bipartisan phenomenon of my lifetime. Now, that is not true. And I would love to talk to Mr. Sterling and explain that that is not true. That, let me read this paragraph again. Let me show you. I'm going to come back over here and show you this paragraph. These two paragraphs right here. The explosion of debt has been the only bipartisan phenomenon of my lifetime. This is not true. The book that I was writing, I played around with with different titles, but the subtitle was From Peace and Prosperity to Endless War and Massive Debt. From Peace and Prosperity to Endless War and Massive Debt. That is what you see going on here in this chart. The significant thing about this era right here, from, he starts here in 1996, and the explosion starts, he says right here, this is the paragraph after that. Let's read this whole paragraph. The acceleration started, this paragraph. The explosion of debt has been the only bipartisan phenomenon of my lifetime. For us conservatives, we can't blame it all on Biden and Obama. Nope. For Democrats, you can't put this all on Trump. It's both parties and all presidents and every Congress. And so that's why. And if you look at the chart, he's got the presidents up here: Clinton, Bush, Obama, Trump, Biden. And when I saw this, I was like, you know, you should have the speakers of the House, their names up here, because Congress is responsible for debt. You send these guys, like in Trump's case, everyone's talking about all the debt that Trump, added to the national debt. Trump was sent two omnibus spending bills that he did not want to sign either of those. He did, but, and I explained how without line item veto power, and if you look at the first omnibus spending bill, they waited to the last minute. They put the military and military funding, used that as leverage. Paul Ryan was the Speaker of the House. So Paul Ryan sent him this omnibus and used the military as leverage in forcing him to sign it. He signed it. I don't have time to play the speech. After when he signs that omnibus and says, I'm never going to sign another bill like that again. But he did sign another bill like that again, because in 2020, Nancy Pelosi sent him an omnibus and used COVID aid and taking care of the American people as leverage. If he vetoes this omnibus, then he's vetoing aid for the country. He's running for re-election. So they used that leverage on him, forced him to sign that omnibus twice. It happened. So it's not only the president's. He's got the president's names up here, but he should have the Congress's name up here, because Congress is responsible for the debt. All right, back up here to this paragraph. I want to show you guys something. The acceleration started under George W. Bush. Now, this goes back to what we were talking about in the last podcast, the Project for the New American Century. You know, all of this started under the George W. Bush administration. The explosion of the debt started under George W. Bush. The wars taking us, and so going back to the title of my book, the subtitle, from peace and prosperity to endless war and massive debt. George Bush is the one who took us from an era of peace and prosperity. During this time, that's a significant thing that you got to understand. The Cold War was over. The Cold War ended. And the war on terrorism hadn't started yet. So the significant thing that you have to understand about this period of time, we were running budget surpluses. We were paying off the debt. We were at peace. We had prosperity. There was a technological boom in this era. This was the era of Pax Americana. We were about to set off to have a long period of Pax Americana, but that was thwarted right here in the George Bush administration. It started under George Bush. The acceleration started under George W. Bush. Bush went into 2002 with less than $6 trillion of debt. It's $34.3 trillion right now. In 2002, when Bush went into 2002, it was $6 trillion. It's $34 trillion now. Thanks to GWOT, what is that? Military spending, tax cuts, we probably couldn't afford. $6 trillion grew to $7 trillion in 23 months, and then $8 trillion in another 20. So he's just basically explaining how all this happened. Now, what you have to understand is that none of this debt is by accident. If you're new to listening to my podcast, you may have never heard about this document that I'm getting ready to talk to you about. If you've listened to my podcast before and have been listening to me for a number of years, then you have heard about this document, because this document is so key to understanding what happened here. Again, the subtitle of my book was From Peace and Prosperity to Endless War and Massive Debt. That there is a correlation. That's the point that I want to make, is that there is a correlation between peace and prosperity and war and debt. So this document is called Life After Debt. This is the PDF of the entire document. Let me get it up here for you. You can see. So the document is called Life After Debt. It was written in the year 2000. This is Bill Clinton's last year in office. U.S. Treasury, I think, drafted this document, and the person who was the head of Treasury at this time was Lawrence Larry Sumners, for official use only. So NPR had to file a FOIA request for this document. So going back to this chart, this document was written here in 2000. Here in 2000, when we are having budget surpluses, you know, getting ready to set off for Pax Americana, paying down debt, peacetime. This document was written in 2000. When NPR sues and gets this document from a FOIA request, that was in 2011. So we're already here. The ball is already rolling once this document becomes public, okay? So what is in this document? I want you to take a listen. This is a reporter from NPR, the reporter who sued to get this document, and he is interviewing someone from the Clinton administration at that time, and they talk about this document. Take a listen.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
I'm Melissa Block. And now a story about a secret government document that dates from the Clinton administration, outlining what was believed to be a looming potential crisis. Not a matter of terrorism or national security.
No, crisis! Crisis! What is this crisis, people? Listen to it. They identified it as a crisis. I think that's very important.
Considered, I'm Robert Siegel.
I'm Melissa Block. And now a story about a secret government document that dates from the Clinton administration, outlining what was believed to be a looming potential crisis. Not a matter of terrorism or national security. No, the crisis was, imagine this, the possibility that the U.S. might pay off its entire debt. Air debt. David Kestenbaum with our Planet Money team got hold of the document and explains why it was buried until today.
The document is called Life After Debt. I heard about it from Diane Lim Rogers, an economist at the White House who reviewed it at the time. It was written in 2000, and Diane had not seen it since then, until I gave her the copy. For her, it brought home just how much has happened since then.
Wow. I mean, the document just reminded me of a lot of things I'd forgotten. Like, I'd completely forgotten that we were projecting that the debt would be completely paid off by 2012.
Remember those times?
So they were projecting. The document was written here in 2000, and they were projecting at the rate that we were going during Pax Americana, paying off debt, peace, at peace, you know, technological innovations. We were getting ready to set off like a rocket here. They were predicting, when this document came out in 2000, that by 2012 here, we were going to be completely debt free. No more debt. And that was the crisis. That was the crisis that they identified. All right.
The document just reminded me of a lot of things I'd forgotten. Like, I'd completely forgotten that we were projecting that the debt would be completely paid off by 2012.
Remember those times? The economy was booming. The U.S. government was actually running a surplus, taking in more than it was spending.
And we were at peace. So he doesn't. So that's a significant. Not only was the economy booming, not only were the tax receipts high, not only was there innovation, but there was peace. He doesn't clarify that peace is a significant characteristic, a significant thing that we were experiencing at this time that led to the prosperity. The peace led to the prosperity. I'm going to show that to you.
That we were projecting that the debt would be completely paid off by 2012.
Remember those times? The economy was booming. The U.S. government was actually running a surplus, taking in more than it was spending. This sounds like a good thing, and everyone agreed it was. But it also posed a danger. A danger that this document was spelling out. If the U.S. paid off its debt, there would be no more U.S. Treasury bonds.
Oh, man.
That's how the U.S. borrows money.
Oh, who's that going to hurt? Who's that going to hurt if we don't have any more Treasury bonds? Oh, man.
It sells bonds. So no more debt meant no more bonds. But the U.S. has been issuing bonds for so long, has been in debt for so long, that the entire world has come to depend on those bonds.
So I guess that's why this is a good thing. This is a good thing, I guess. Living in a clown world, people.
A reference point for the entire global economy. Banks buy hundreds of billions of dollars worth because they're safe places to park your money. There's a good chance your mortgage is tied to the interest rate on U.S. Treasury bonds. The Federal Reserve, our central bank, buys and sells Treasury bonds all the time to keep the economy on track. If you took Treasury bonds away, would the world unravel?
Oh, my
God. Would it adjust somehow?
It was a dramatic issue. It was a huge issue for not just the U.S. economy, but the global economy. And that's why we felt initially that we had to address it somehow.
All right. So we had to address it somehow, is what she says. That it was a dramatic issue. Oh, my God, we're not going to have Treasury bonds anymore. The American people are going to be debt free. They're not going to be slaves. Oh, my God. It was such a dramatic issue. We had to do something about it. And I always ask every time I talk about life after debt and this document, what'd y'all do? What'd you guys do? How'd you guys address this problem? Huh? Because the problem is obviously been addressed. the crisis has been averted. I would say that. So how did we get into this period of Pax Americana? Again, the period is between the end of the Cold War and the beginning of the War on Terrorism. This is a period of peace and prosperity. And America at this time was, I mean, the future for America was bright. Very, very bright. How did we get in this state of peace and prosperity? Well, the Cold War was over. Of course, the Soviet Union was defeated. We outspent them. But after the Cold War was over, and we were spending all of this money on the Cold War, then the government started closing down military bases all over the United States. This is the commission that they put together to do that. Make it where you can see it. It's called the Base Realignment and Closure Commission. It was called the BRAC Commission. And it says base realignment and closure, BRAC, was a process by the United States federal government commissioned to increase the efficiency of the United States Department of Defense by coordinating and realigning and closure of military institutions following the end of the Cold War. So the war was over. We didn't need these military institutions anymore. So we started closing them down all over the United States. I lived in a town and grew up in a town this, where the naval base in my hometown was the largest institution. It was the biggest employer in the community, and there was like 3 or 4 other bases within 20, 30-mile drives around that location. And when the BRAC Commission started in the late 80s and in the 90s, I remember those institutions, those bases in Beeville and other bases in the surrounding area in South Texas being closed. I remember a huge downsizing of the military base there in Corpus Christi, Texas, where I live. So this was happening all over the country. It says over 350 installations have been closed in 5 BRAC rounds in 1988 and 1991. Again, the chart starts here in 1996. So that's where he picks it up. So it took some time. Once these base closures started to close, it took some time for this money to be redirected back into the country to pay down debt. That was a huge for Newt Gingrich when he was Speaker of the House, and he made that a priority to pay down the debt, and he held Bill Clinton to account, and Bill Clinton was on board. There was no need to have all this spending anymore. There was no war. There was no war. So this money starts getting redirected back into the country, and then the chart picks up right here at 1996. So that's how we get the Pax Americana, peace and prosperity. 1991, 1993, 1995, and then 2005. Those are the rounds of BRAC closures. It says these 5 BRAC rounds constituted a combined savings of $12 billion annually. That doesn't sound like a lot of money, but when you have a national debt of $4 trillion, this is a lot of money. That's a lot of money. So the peace contributed to the prosperity. Also, the technological innovations contributed to the prosperity. And so you have to understand that war is a racket, like Smedley Butler said. So the way that what these people did when they saw that we were getting ready to pay off our debt and be completely debt free and within the next decade, we were getting ready to set off a long period of Pax Americana. These people took us to war, because war is how you get debt. And this goes back to what we were talking about in the last podcast about the project for the new American century, and how these people theorize a new Pearl Harbor, a new Pearl Harbor event that they needed to kick this period off, a period of endless war and massive debt. So we've been at war for the past 24 years, and the debt continues to climb. Each one of these colors, each one of these bars, it is $1 trillion. And that's what Mr. Sterling is freaking out about here, is how fast we are getting to $1 trillion now. That it's taking us 90 to 120 days to get to $1 trillion, when it took 6 years back during Pax Americana. Anyway, We're still at war right now, and we are on the verge of World War III, people. We're on the verge of World War III, and it is something that you need to be aware of, because they are escalating the war in Ukraine. And, you know, this is a different time. They want, again, I told you that they want to get the Cold War, you know, going again, because the Cold War was big business. The Cold War was big business. So they want to get that going again. The only problem is that we are playing with fire, because we are in the nuclear age. The first Cold War was in the nuclear age, but still it makes no sense getting the Cold War intentions with Russia kicked off again and putting us, you know, closer and closer to a serious war where a lot of people die. A lot more than just Ukrainians and Russians. Hawkish Macron refuses to back down on the possibility of Western troops in Ukraine. So Macron is saying that, you know, he may send French troops to Ukraine. That's what this guy's saying. This is crazy. Now, at the same time, you have people like the Pope, Pope Francis. You know, Pope Francis is trying to get Ukraine to surrender. He gave statements this last weekend or this past week saying that that there's no, what did he say? There's no the courage to that. That's what he says. He says that Ukraine must have the courage to raise the white flag. And all of the war hawks, all of the people who want this war to continue, they went in on Pope Francis. Let's see here. I got some stuff. Pope Francis here. Where's the picture of Pope Francis with blood on his hands? Anyway, listen to this. This was the Secretary General of NATO. He comes out and criticizes the Pope and says, no, we're not waving the white flag. We're moving, you know, full steam ahead. I have a lot of criticisms of this Pope. A lot of criticisms of Pope Francis. But he's named after Francis of Assisi's, people. I mean, the fact that he's calling for peace should let you know something about this war. He's calling, not only calling for peace, he's calling for Ukraine to negotiate, to raise the white flag and surrender and to come to the negotiating table, something that Putin's been willing to do for a long time. But the war hawks, let me show you what they say. This is the Secretary General of NATO criticizing the Pope.
And he could end it today. But Ukraine does not have this option. Surrender is not peace. We must continue to strengthen Ukraine, to show President Putin that he will not get what he wants on the battlefield, but must sit down and negotiate a solution where Ukraine is recognized and prevails as a sovereign, independent nation.
So I'm sure so listen to what he's saying. So he's saying that it's not up to Ukraine to surrender and to that Putin, it's up to Putin. So Putin says that he wants to go to the negotiating table. And I'm going to show you that as soon as the coup was, you know, over in 2014, Putin did try to negotiate before he moved his armies in. This is so the French president, Macron, is saying that he wants to send troops. And I don't know how that's going to work, because if he sends troops and he's a member of NATO, then once his troops start dying, what does he declare Article 5, and then everybody has to go and fight, you know, with him because this moron sends troops. France has come a long way since back in 2003 when, like I was explaining to you last week, when George Bush was trying to, not trying to take, he was trying to get the UN to sanction his illegal invasion of Iraq. France was the, you remember when they changed the name of the French fries and French toast in the congressional cafeteria in 2003, because France, they were not buying George Bush's story of weapons of mass destruction. They were putting up the biggest fight in the Security Council, and they were the ones saying that they were going to veto any resolution. They were real advocates for peace. What has happened to France since then? But you remember them changing the name of the French fries and French toast in the congressional cafeteria, like, ooh, that's going to hurt France. But this was the prime minister back then, and he goes in. It's in French. I'm not going to play much of it, but he goes in on Macron.
Et pour que ce débat puisse être utile, il eût fallu au préalable que nous soyons capables de répondre à cinq questions, cinq risques qui sont liés à cette montée en gamme, à cette étape que nous franchirions si nous...
He says there are five risks associating with this step we would be taking if we were to send ground troops and combatants into Ukraine. So this is what...
Envoyons des troupes au sol, des combattants. Cinq risques.
Five risks.
Le premier, c'est l'élargissement du conflit.
So the first is the risk of widening the conflict. Bah, duh. That's a no-brainer. That's a no-brainer that sending troops into Ukraine is just going to widen the conflict. Like I was just saying, then right now, just Ukrainians and Russians are dying. That if we send troops, if France sends troops and then ends up declaring or, you know, invoking an Article 5, then it's going to widen the conflict, then the French are going to start dying. And then just like in Vietnam, it was first the French dying, and then the French got us involved in Vietnam, and then now Americans are dying. Do you guys remember Vietnam? Did we win Vietnam? Is there a Saigon right now or a Ho Chi Minh City? Listen to more Villepin here.
Si nous envoyons des troupes au sol, savons-nous
if we send troops, do we know whether other countries will send ground troops and fight on Russia's side?
Si du côté russe, d'autres pays enverront de l'autre côté des troupes au sol. Est-ce que nous aurons des combattants africains? Est-ce que nous aurons des combattants...
Will we face African fighters? Will the Africans come and fight with the Russians?
Asiatique,
will the Asians? Will China? Will the Middle Eastern countries? Will Saudi Arabia? I mean, do you understand? This is world war, is what Villepin is saying. It's absolute madness. But like I told you, right here, Speaker Johnson, Politico, Speaker Johnson just shared new details of his plans to take up Ukraine and Israel aid, including his expectation to pass it with Democratic votes. Expectation to pass it with Democratic votes. Can I tell you? I told you in the last podcast, I knew what this guy was going to do. I knew what this guy was going to do. Speaker Johnson just shared details on how he plans to take up Ukraine and Israel aid, including his expectation to pass it with Democratic votes, because he's not going to be able to get Republican votes. So he's going to join with the Democrats. What a surprise. The pressure got too high for him.
The fight in Ukraine is a fight for democracy, not only there.
He had this guy and other people visiting and going to his office this week. I mean, they put a lot of pressure on this guy this week. But I knew what he was going to do. Nancy Pelosi here, you remember this is, I don't know if this is him or his brother because they're identical twins, but this was the guy who was on the call when Trump was, you know, talking to Zelensky, the call that got Trump impeached, because they're covering up stuff in Ukraine. People, they're covering up stuff in Ukraine.
The fight in Ukraine is a fight for democracy, not only there, but in the other states surrounding it, and a challenge to all of us.
So that's why
we're saying to the speaker, the right thing to do is to honor the wishes of the House, the strong bipartisan support.
What about the people? What about honoring the wishes of the people? It's like 50-50 of Americans that want to keep supporting this war, and the numbers keep growing of the people who don't want to support the war. What about the people? And what about that debt, Nancy Pelosi? The fact that we're $34 trillion in debt and we're adding $1 trillion to our national debt every 90 to 120 days. How about that?
The right thing to do is to honor the wishes of the House, the strong bipartisan support that is there, and give us a vote. And that's the fastest way. We have other techniques, as I say. They take a little more time, and time is a very valuable, valuable commodity when you're getting shot at and you don't have the proper equipment initiate.
So why don't you do what the Pope said and wave the white flag and negotiate peace and end this war? So I was thinking about this. So I was thinking about $95 billion. $95 billion. Now, you remember when we had the housing crisis in 2008 and we did the bank bailout TARP? It was something like $80 billion. And we were like, that's crazy. That's a lot of money. How much was TARP? Let me look real quick. I'm interested. Hold on. Let's see here. I'm interested in how much TARP was. I think it was about 80. Hold on. Oh, no, I'm sorry. Hold on. Yeah, it was. Oh, yeah. So TARP was almost a trillion. Yeah, it's like 80. I said 80 billion. No, TARP was 700 billion. 700 billion. Anyway, so forget that. But $95 billion is still a lot of money. So I was thinking about this, that this $95 billion supplemental, everyone's been saying how this money is going to come back into the American economy because it's going to come to American defense contractors, and the American defense contractors are going to send Ukraine our old weapons. That's the other thing they say, that we're going to send Ukraine our old weapons, and then we're going to buy ourselves new weapons to replace our stockpiles. There's tons of people who have said this, that this is going to benefit us and benefit our economy. So I'm thinking to myself, so you're going to pass $95 billion in supplemental spending that is going to then in turn come back to our economy and boost up our GDP just in time for Joe Biden's reelection? Diabolical. All right, so this is all a scam, and that's what I've been explaining to you guys about with Ukraine. Oh, that's right, Turkey. Also, Turkey is a member of NATO, and Turkey's also pressuring Ukraine to wave the white flag, like the Pope said, and to go to the negotiating table and to negotiate peace. And Erdogan, Turkey says that not only should you do this, Zelensky, but we will help Turkey as a NATO member. We will help negotiate this. Now, this is really interesting. Now, France is a member of NATO. Turkey is a member of NATO. And France is ready to send troops to help Ukraine. And Turkey saying that not only should you negotiate peace, but we will help Turkey. We will help facilitate the negotiation. Why isn't Joe Biden doing this? Why is Erdogan doing this? Why isn't Joe Biden saying that we will help facilitate peace talks? Because they want that money.
So Ukraine might be about to sign a peace deal with Russia. Today, the Ukrainian President Zelensky went to Turkey and they actually discussed peace options with the Turkish president. The Turkish president tweeted out on Twitter everything that they spoke about, so I'll tell you what happened. So obviously, Zelensky went to Turkey looking for more funding for the war. But what Turkey actually said was that they're happy to mediate and host peace agreements between both Ukraine and Russia, which is totally the opposite of what Zelensky wants, but I think peace is probably his best option at the moment because there's just so many people being killed from both sides. One of the main things that the Turkish president said in his statement was, from the very beginning, we have contributed as much as we could to ending the war on a basis of negotiations. So he seems very adamant in peace is the only really good option at the moment. The Turkish president also said that if they can't come to a peace agreement, Turkey is happy to reach their goal of donating $10 billion over the course of 2024. And that's money going to Ukraine in military funding, mainly to fight Russia. They also said a lot about how Turkey is happy to help Ukraine reconstruct.
It's a money pit. It's a money pit. It's a money pit. So they're going to get $10 million from Turkey. So that's their obligation. So everybody's obligated to get. So why would you end this war when you're making so much money off of it? It's a scam, people. War is a racket, like my man Smedley Butler said. And this racket was all created. Now let's get back into how we got here, people. Because I think it's very important to understand how we got here. In 2014, the Euromaidan protests that started in November of 2013, everybody came to the square there in Independence Square in the Maidan to protest that Viktor Yanukovych, the democratically elected president, was withdrawing from a trade deal, trade negotiations with the EU. So all these people, mostly people from the eastern part or from the western part of Ukraine, came into Maidan. Came to Maidan to protest, and violence kicked off. Really bad violence on February 20th, 2014. Someone started sniping at both the government officials and the protesters, and amongst the protesters was a small group of Nazi fascists who were well armed. So when someone on the morning of February 20th, 2014 started sniping and killing both the Yanukovych security forces and sniping and killing protesters, then the Nazis and the security forces started shooting back and forth at each other. And then from there, the violence of February 20th, February 21st kicked off. I mean, they set the entire square on fire. And then Yanukovych had to flee Ukraine. And then after fleeing Ukraine, the new government that takes control is a government that we put in place. Victoria Nuland says that she thinks that Viktor Yanukovych should be the new prime minister, and Victoria Nuland says in the phone call that was leaked that Arseniy Yatsenyuk. Arseniy Yatsenyuk should be the new prime minister, and Arseniy Yatsenyuk becomes the new prime minister. And Oleksandr Turchynov becomes the new president. the first thing that the new government does after they oust Viktor Yanukovych is they repeal a law that Yanukovych had put in place that made Russian, the Russian language, an official language in the eastern part of Ukraine. Let's get this over here. So, in this area of Ukraine, in these areas, Odessa, Crimea, Donetsk, Mariupol, the Russian language was the most people in this these areas spoke the Russian language. So a couple of years earlier from the coup, I think in 2012, Yanukovych passes a law making Russian the official language in these areas. And that meant that Russian is used in, you know, court proceedings. It's used on ballots. It's used in everyday life. It's used. So the Nazis, the people from the western part of Ukraine who aligned more with the European Union, the same people who went to Kiev to protest in 2014, they did not like the fact that Yanukovych had made the Russian language an official language here. They also didn't like the fact that Yanukovych had that he had rescinded the hero status that that Viktor Yushchenko had given to Stefan Bandera. So when the coup is over and they attempt to change to repeal this law that Yanukovych had put in place, making the Russian language the official language in these areas, they force Yanukovych out, stage this violent coup, and the very first thing they do is repeal this law, you know, saying that the Russian language is the official language. Now, the president, Oleksandr Turchynov, he vetoes it, but it still showed the people in these area in these areas that this new government that has just staged a violent coup in Kiev, they're hostile to us. That they're going to be hostile to us. That these people have to, we have to move to declare our independence. We have to move to join Russia. And Crimea was the first. Crimea had a referendum on the ballot in Crimea within 2 weeks after the coup, and they were moving to separate from Ukraine and to be annexed by Russia. Again, I told you that was two different things. The think Texas. The declaration and winning of their independence is different from the annexation. United States didn't annex Texas for a decade after they won their independence. The Donetsk region, as I'm going to show you here in a moment, they declared their independence immediately in the summer of 2014. They held a referendum after Crimea, declared their independence. Russia doesn't annex them until 2022, but because of the strategic location of Crimea, the naval base in Sevastopol, Russia does annex them immediately. But I'm going to show you, it wasn't immediate. It wasn't like they voted for their independence and immediately Russia annexed. This whole time, the United States governments, the government in the West, they're telling us that Russia is invading Crimea. That is ridiculous. Russia did not invade Crimea at all. I want you to listen to this interview. This is a BBC interview with a woman from Crimea, and they go back and forth about what happened in Crimea after the coup. Let's take a listen.
Thousands of Russian troops have encircled Crimea. Paratroopers have gone in. That is intimidation. That is not the way international law works today.
So what he's saying, this so this BBC reporter is lying. So what he's telling her is that as the referendums are going on, and this is why the Obama administration and the West tried to say that those referendums that happened in Crimea, that happened in the Donbass region, that those are not legitimate referendums because the Russians were there making sure people voted the right way. So that's the narrative that he's expressing here, that the Russian troops were on the ground and they were and because the Russian troops were there, that means that the referendum was not fair. It's absolutely ridiculous. The first of all, again, Russia has a naval base in Crimea, so of course Russian troops are there. But yes, Russian troops did come to protect the people of Crimea because the right sector Nazis were coming into Crimea and they were trying to intimidate them. Back to this clip. I played this, if I didn't play it in the last podcast, the podcast before that, but this is the Vice News report, and the guy's is showing how there's actually people protesting against the referendum, that people are protesting that they want to stay with Ukraine. If Russia was there on the streets the way this BBC reporter is saying, then they wouldn't be allowing people to protest against the referendum. If the Russian government or the Russian military was there, not allowing people to express their opinions and forcing people to vote for the independence of Crimea, you wouldn't see this.
This is the first sizable pro-Ukraine protest that we've seen in Crimea yet, and we've already been here almost a week.
Pro-Ukraine. So this is a pro-Ukraine protest in Crimea. I mean, if the Russians are there on the streets and they are forcing everybody to support independence, how do you have this mass crowd of pro-Ukraine protests going on in Crimea? It makes no sense.
Well, pro-Ukraine protests that we've seen in Crimea yet, and we've already been here almost a week. And you can really tell that it's not Russia quite yet, because if this was Russia, the police would already be here chasing these people off of the square.
All right, so he's there on the ground in Crimea just before the referendum. So what's this guy talking about that the Russians are on the ground there in Crimea? It's an absolute lie.
Paratroopers have gone in. That is intimidation. That is not the way international law works today.
To be honest, there were no troops on the streets in Crimea. So yesterday I came from Yalta. There were no some soldiers or tanks.
There were no soldiers. There were no tanks. I mean, you see it right here with the Vice guy. He tells you this is not Russia. The Russians are not here preventing people from protesting or anything.
It's not Russia quite yet, because if this was Russia, the police would already be.
So who's telling the truth here in this when she says that she just came from Ukraine, just like he's in Ukraine or in Crimea? He's in Crimea. She says, I just came from Crimea. There's no troops on the ground. But you're in London and you're telling me the troops are there, huh?
To be honest, there were no troops on the streets in Crimea. So yesterday I came from Yalta. There were no some soldiers or tanks. The information that people voted or wanted to join Russia under control or under pressure, it's not true. People are really Russians. People have relatives in Russia.
Sorry to interrupt you. We filmed lots and we were told they were local militias that had just sprung up spontaneously. They were people who were in trucks which had Moscow number plates. They all wore identical uniforms with their regiments covered up. We filmed this. That's not coincidence, surely. That's straining credulity to say that these are just, you know, a few people who've borrowed some uniforms. They were official Russian forces.
Yeah, but it's also... Sevastopol is a big Russian military base, and it's crowded and full of Russian military
exactly.
forces. But they also stay sort of legally there. That's kind of, I think it's also sort of mixture here.
I understand
the 18th
that.
Century,
I understand
bud.
That.
Do you understand?
Yeah, I mean, I just wonder whether what your reaction is. Look, here you are, a very international person. You spend a lot of your time in London. I think you've got, I think on your family, there's some Ukrainian, you know, your husband on that side. So I just wonder what you think about Russia being isolated. Why do you think the world community is taking such an angry decision? You couldn't even count on the support of China in the United Nations.
That's what's actually so surprising.
It's surprising
because
to
in
me
reality,
too.
The whole story did not start with the Crimea, did not start even with Russia. It's not the Russia who suddenly started this crisis. And actually, it's a new government which now sits in Kiev. The first
the Nazi
thing
government.
Which they did, you remember last time.
The Nazi government. She's talking about the Nazi government in Kiev that Victoria Nuland put in power.
They did. You remember last time we met in your studio. I mean, my relatives and nobody in Crimea, they did not want to join to Russia. They did not want to annex. They hoped that they got rid of their corrupted president Yanukovych and now something new will happen. But what they will see, we saw that the people who were in the power in 2004, who actually created this Orange Revolution, they again came to the power. But in addition, they brought Nazis, neo-fascists, xenophobians. They immediately forbidden Russian language. They started to give threats. That's what actually happened. That's why it became hysteria. And actually, the government itself pushed people to join together to take this decision in Crimea and to ask Russia, president of Russia, government of Russia, to help and to protect. It's not like we are Crimeans. Suddenly we decided out of why we would not start now joining the Russia. No, it's not what we wanted.
But I kept on hearing about that the Russia was taking this action to protect its citizens and that
from
a possible attack. I mean, we've had reporters in Ukraine. We've been trying to cover every aspect of this story. We haven't seen Russian speakers being attacked. We've seen in Crimea the intimidation of people who wanted to stay with Kiev. We've seen them being intimidated. We've seen people being stabbed in Donetsk and the like. But we haven't seen these anti-Russian attacks. I just wonder where they are. They part of the imagination.
Interesting. So we haven't seen these anti-Russian attacks. Okay. So it's funny because they are probably, it doesn't have a date on here of when this interview is taking place. Now, you remember, so we're in 2014, we're February, late February, the coup happens, Yanukovych flees by February 24th. By mid-March, Crimea has does the first referendum, they're annexed by late March. Now, the Donbas region, Odessa, Mariupol, these other regions, they're starting to move to follow what Crimea has done. And this guy says, we haven't seen any of the people being attacked in Crimea. Well, there weren't people being attacked in Crimea because Crimea moved to protect themselves. Crimea is strategically located too. That there's only these two roads. These two roads are the only roads into Crimea. So, so what Right Sector did, I may show you these videos in the last, but they had blocked off these roads. They weren't allowing anything to come in to Crimea. And so there's a bridge that goes across here to Russia. So Russia was supplying them with supplies and everything because they couldn't get anything from Ukraine. So they were acting very, very hostile. So when the Russians came out to protect the people of Crimea, that's why the Nazis weren't able to come in and do what they ended up doing in Odessa, which I'm getting ready to show you here in a moment, what they end up doing in Mariupol. If the Russians military wouldn't have come out and to protect them, you would have seen what you saw in Odessa, what you saw in Mariupol. So it's kind of ridiculous for this guy to say, well, I haven't seen any Russian speakers getting attacked in Ukraine. Yeah, because the Russians were there protecting them. But take a look at what happened in Odessa. just a few weeks later, just a few weeks later, what happened in Odessa? We're going to have that. And this will probably be the last thing that I show you guys, and we'll get back into this in the next podcast. All right. This is what happened in Odessa.
The world seemed too busy welcoming this new democracy in Kiev to notice what was being done as it spread its wings over the country. Many in southern Ukraine had been viewing the revolution with concern.
Now here it is.
And an anti-Maidan movement formed in the city of Odessa in early January 2014. The protesters set up their camp in front of the Trade Union House, a building which would soon become a monument to a massacre of its own. It's difficult to overestimate the importance of Odessa. It is strategically located on the Black Sea, and it's Ukraine's largest seaport. It's not surprising that Ukraine's new authorities were watching the situation unfolding there with growing alarm. More and more of Odessa's people were joining the anti-Maidan movement at the same time as events in eastern Ukraine were heating up. The new Ukrainian government didn't have the power to wage war on too many fronts. If Odessa were to join the growing uprising in the eastern regions, it would seriously complicate the situation. This rebellion had to be extinguished immediately and at any cost, and that cost was high. On May 2, 2014, soccer fans flocked to the center of Odessa City for the Ukrainian championship match. Surprisingly, a great number of these fans who descended into Odessa just the night before also turned out to be fighters from the Maidan self-defense units.
So these, Along with these people... Sorry. I gotta figure out these hotkeys. I'm going to... So these are people that... that were in Maidan, and now they're down in Odessa, okay? These are the armed people, the armed Nazis, the right sector Nazis that are down in Odessa now, okay? This is in May. This is a few months after the coup.
Also turned out to be fighters from the Maidan self-defense units, along with members of radical organizations from all parts of Ukraine.
Slava Nazis!
Slava!
Ukraina!
Slava Rusei!
These fans, masked, armed, and shouting nationalist mottos, began disturbances in the center of the city as they marched to the anti-Maidan tent encampment, where they attacked. The anti-Maidan protesters sought shelter in the Trade Union House, but it was a trap. Maidan supporters started throwing Molotov cocktails into the building until it was engulfed in flames. People burned to death inside, or, trying to escape, jumped from the windows.
Man, so
although a fire station was less than a mile away.
That's called the Odessa Massacre, where the right sector Nazis burned Russian speakers alive. And just a few months earlier, this BBC reporter is telling this Crimean woman that the Russians didn't need to be there protecting them.
We've seen them being intimidated. We've seen people being stabbed in Donetsk and the like. But we haven't seen these anti-Russian attacks. I just wonder where they... Are they part of the imagination?
Oh, they're part of the imagination. We haven't seen these anti-Russian attacks. They're part of the imagination, huh? Wow.
Russians, people have relatives...
Get these hotkeys figured out. I put a bunch of